Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is, of course, the Ultimate Classic Rock Podcast that says that my music is better than yours. Make sure to subscribe on your podcast app right now so that you don't miss a single episode, because I've got some great guests lined up for you in coming weeks. A big shout out as well to Pantheon Podcast Network. Pantheon Podcasts hosts some incredible music podcasts from all genres and styles, including the official Metallica podcast. Yes, the Metallica Report is the band's only official podcast, and you can only get that on the Pantheon Podcast Network, as well as so many other great shows like my friends Mac and Action Jackson on the Ugly American Werewolf in London podcast. There's Joe from Play That Rock and Roll podcast, Tom and Zeus on Shout It Out Loud, and of course, the Stephanies on Stephanie and Stephanie Talk Tunes. Loads of great shows. Please do go and check them all out on the Pantheon Podcast Network. But today then, I've got a great guest for you on the show, a man who, unbelievably, is 70 years old. He'd pass as a man in his 40s, or, well, early 50s at worst, I tell you. He's in great shape. He is one of the greatest drummers of the last 40 years. Rolling Stone ranked him in the top 100 of all time. Modern Drummer magazine ranked him the number one session drummer in the world 5 times. And Drum magazine ranked him the number one session drummer 3 times as well. And a quick glance at his recording history shows you the array of amazing talent who've trusted him on their records. From John Fogerty to Celine Dion, there's Tony Iommi and Bob Seger, the Smashing Pumpkins, to Lynyrd Skynyrd, Meatloaf and Joe Satriani, Jerry Lee Lewis, the famous Highwaymen, you know, Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson. Honestly, that is just the tip of the iceberg. He's played with McCartney and Ringo, the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, Sting, Billy Gibbons, Rod Stewart, Elton John, Dave Grohl. I mean, seriously, this is a true legend. The guy is a true drumming legend, and he tells such amazing, inspiring stories too. He got his first real break in the business with, well, a little-known hit album called American Fool that contained another little-known single called Jack and Diane, working with a little-known guy called John Cougar Mellencamp. You may have heard of them. Anyway, I am, of course, talking about the wonderful Kenny Aronoff. Kenny is an amazing guest, and he's a great storyteller, and in fact hosts his own podcast as well, so please do go and check that out as well, where he speaks to his rock and roll friends. But in this interview, you're going to hear about his friendship with another drumming legend, the late great Rush's Neil Peart, his time working with John Mellencamp, of course, the hits, the difficult working environment, and how he made the jump into the session world, his time with Creedence legend John Fogerty, the Smashing Pumpkins, Tony Iommi, and of course that incredible night, the evening with Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. So please enjoy this chat with the amazing Kenny Aronoff. Before we get started, I want to say that your book, Sex, Drums, Rock and Roll, came out a few years ago. It's absolutely fantastic. You've got loads of brilliant stories in there, really in depth, some brilliant pictures and things like that in there. So we're going to touch on certain little bits from that, but I recommend everybody to check out that book, Sex, Drums and Rock and Roll, because it is brilliant. And I want to say as well that the foreword was written by the legend that was Neil Peart. I mean, if there's anyone going to write a foreword for a drummer, then he's got to be up there at the top of the list, hasn't he? How did all that come about?
Well, Neil and I had worked together when he was producing the Buddy Rich big band, Burning for Buddy Rich, and it was a two CDs on Atlantic Records, and I was in the early 90s, and I was called by Kathy Rich, Buddy's daughter, to be part of that recording, and Neil was producing, so I met him on that, and then, he was very, 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 very nice, very sweet, very focused, knew what he wanted to do, and that was done in New York, but later that year, I was recording up at Moran Heights, which is a studio where Rush had recorded and all kinds of bands about maybe an hour outside of Montreal. And I was recording with Corey Hart. And all of a sudden, I see Neil's head pop through the door, very humbly going, trying to get my attention. I went, Neil, what are you doing here? Had no idea that they had worked there a lot. I didn't think about it at the time. And then he asked me if I could play percussion with him on like eight or 16 measures of Pick Up the Pieces that Steve Ferroni had played drums on. Steve didn't want to do a drum solo, and Neil thought it'd be cool if we did a whole percussion thing together. And we did, and I'd done a lot of percussion and orchestrating that sort of thing on Mellencamp Records, so I kind of knew you can start from low frequencies, you start working your way up through percussion till you get the high frequencies. And I was sharing those ideas with Neil, and we had an incredible time. We talked about me being the Ball Bandito brothers, and then I went to his house, and later that day, and we listened to the whole record and drank some scotch, and we became very good friends. And then when it was time for me to get somebody to do the forward of the book, I wanted somebody that understood me. Now, he and I both are into jazz, both ended up as rock drummers, and both of us are very into sports. And I thought, this guy will understand me on those levels. And he asked me to send him three chapters, and he said, this is great. So he wrote the forward, and it was pretty close to when he was diagnosed with cancer. So I felt honored.
What a shame.
You know.
Well, like I said, everyone check out the book. It is fantastic to read, and you'll hear more stories in there than we can get through on a little interview like this. But definitely check out Sex, Drums, Rock and Roll. So you mentioned Mellencamp quickly there. We have to start there, really, don't we? I mean, a long and fruitful career, an association with John, and some fantastic hits, some great records, that sort of thing. But first off, what was it like working with John in the studio, creating songs and putting records together?
Well, there was a lot of pressure on us, because he had a lot of pressure on him. He'd already lost his record deal. Then, and the first record that came out where he had a record deal, they changed his name from John Mellencamp, which is his family name or given name, to Johnny Cougar, and he was not happy with that. And when the record came out, it didn't do well. He lost his deal in 1 year. So when he finally got another deal, he was adamant about being successful. And we would rehearse from 11 in the morning till 5 at night, and then take a dinner break for 2 hours and work from 7 to 11, 5 days a week, like a business.
Wow.
And his whole thing, one day he walked in the studio after we'd had a big success with American Fool, a number one and number two hit single in the top 100 on the Billboard charts, which is, those are the charts. When you're number one on those charts, you're number one. There's a lot of charts, and people say, I've had 20 number one hits. But the charts don't mean anything. This is where you're competing with the Rolling Stones, Elton John, the Police, Tom Petty, you know, whoever is the greatest. And you're competing with the industry on all formats. So if you're number one on that top 100, you are literally number one in the country, if not the world. So after that record, John came in one day and went, listen, you guys, I need ideas. I need ideas. I need hits. I need people to come up with innovative and creative ideas to make my songs become hits on the radio. Because the North Star, and I figured this out after I got fired after being in the band for 5 weeks from making that record, Nothing Matters From What If It Did, suddenly I realized, oh my God, this is not about me at all. This is about me getting a song on the radio. What is my contribution to that song, to that artist? What can I do as a drummer and a person to get that song on the radio to be number one? That's Super Bowl mentality. You're not thinking about you. You're thinking about the team, the song, the artist. It's not about me. That was a huge revelation for me. And that is what made me who I became. So, yeah, he was right. I need ideas to get these songs on the radio to have hits. And he said, Kenny, if somebody has a better drum beat than what you're playing, you play it. And everybody in this band, you don't own your instruments. We all play each other's instruments. Whatever it takes to get a number one hit. And he walked out of the room, and I thought, what a jerk. But he was right. He was right. He says, what do we as a group need to do to get on the radio and beat out Tom Petty and Billy Joel and Sting and the Police and Springsteen and Elton John? I mean, there's only 10 slots in the top 10. So to be number one, you're telling everybody, wow, you just blew everybody out. So he was right in that regard. And that was, so there was a lot of pressure all the time. All the time, whether it was in the studio or on stage, to be great. And we went from playing in front of, you know, 1,000 people to selling out arenas all around America. Yeah. Double nights, two nights in a row, Madison Square Garden, two nights, no opening act, just us, 360 degrees, flying around in private jets. But this didn't come from, this came from hard work, self-discipline, perseverance, and never taking your foot off the gas. We went 8 years nonstop, you know, rehearse for, you know, John would write the songs and we'd have to come up with parts to make those songs great as a team. I mean, it always went to me first. Like, what do you got, Aronoff? After listening to a song once, and I'd be like, and he admitted they all sounded the same. Acoustic guitar, you know, and I'd have to come up with I came up with a method how to come up with creative ideas. But it was a lot of pressure. And then, you know, he would write songs, we'd arrange the songs, go in the studio, rehearse them, throw songs out, regroup, do it again. That would take a year. Mix, master. Then we do promotion, yeah. Make videos, do interviews and stuff for about a month or so, then rehearse for tour, then go on tour. That's 2 years. Take a month off and start again. We did that for 4 consecutive records, and we ended up playing in arenas, and we were set up to possibly go into stadiums, but John quit the music business for about 3 years. He said, I've had enough. He was fried. And that was a real pivotal point for me, because when he quit, and it was at the last show of the Lonesome Jubilee Tour, we just sold out a Summerfest. He says, he throws a bonus check at me back when they gave bonuses out, and he said, man, I'm quitting the music business for 3 years. Mm. Don't spend it in one place. I went, what? I was freaking out. I'd just gotten divorced, and I had, you know, expenses. And I went, wow, if that guy doesn't work, I don't work. I said, that'll never happen again. Well, I decided, all right. The next day I woke up and went, all right, he's not working, but I'm going to work with all the other people that are out there that are big. And I started going to L.A., and started doing sessions, and eventually I got in to the scene where I had drums in New York, Nashville, L.A., Indiana, where I lived, Japan and Germany, and eventually people would fly me all over the world to make records, and ended up playing on, the last I counted was 300 million records sold. You know, that's, you know, I got some gold records here that Meatloaf up there, that sold 400 million records. And then there's a Celine Dion record right there that sold basically 400 million records. Labels making 85 cents in a dollar. You do the math. That's a lot of money they can reinvest in new artists. Well, that whole thing just completely went away. That's why I moved everything to L.A. And you're in my studio, Uncommon Studios L.A., because I have a thing called adapt or die. In any business, doesn't matter if you're on a basketball court or, you know, playing sports or on a rock and roll stage or you're in a corporate boardroom meeting, you know, you have to come up with creative and innovative ideas to solve, come up with solutions to problems, as I did for Jack and Diane, that makes the company millions of dollars. And if you don't, you're going to lose your place. You're going to be not relevant, and you will. That's why I say adapt or die.
Or die. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Just jumping back, you mentioned Jack and Diane there. We have to touch on that. I mean, an incredible song. It's not a normal song in any way. It starts, it stops. It's got different instrumentation. The claps are in there. It's a very strange structured song. And you've got the drum machine on there as well. So take us through the process of putting that one together. And to begin with, how was your feelings about working with the drum machine? Was it your choice or was it kind of something you were told that was going to happen?
It wasn't my choice. I walk into the room, it was the most difficult record I've ever made in my life, and that record won two Grammys and sold millions. We spent 9 weeks at Criteria Studios in Miami, and basically walked out with four songs. Two guys got fired. I almost got a fist fight with John because he was being a complete idiot to me. And I walk in one day and the co-producer's got a metal box. And I went, "Hey, Don, what's that?" And he goes, "Oh, this is the Bee Gees are using it next door. It's the newest thing. It's called the Lin 1 drum machine." I went, "Drum machine? Oh my God, that replaces drummers." And so that was a moment where I got into, I didn't realize it was like survival. It's not fight or flight. For me, it was fight or fight. I grabbed the machine, and this is an adapt or die situation. I grab the machine, grab the manual, and I go, "I'm going to be a part of this new technology." Yeah. If I'd gone sulked and been like, "God, woe is me," I wouldn't have programmed that thing. Somebody else would have programmed. So I just want to be part of it. So I get the manual, and I basically program what I was playing on the drum set. But you have to remember, this is a new technology, a new sound. So, and In the Air Tonight with Phil Collins had already been on, was already on the radio, and that was exactly drum machine and drums. So I program this, I give it back to them. It's got eight outputs. The Lin 1 had eight outputs. They could bring every fader up on the board, and they were mixing stuff. And I'm thinking in the lounge, I'm like, "God, what's going on? Are the drummers being replaced by machines? Is that what's happening? Am I in the horse and buggy business?" And the car showed up. You know, it's like, and you're like, "Hey, guess what? Bye-bye," you know. And 2 hours later, I get summoned into the control room. And John goes, "Hey, dude, we need a drum solo or a drum break right here after the second chorus." And I'm crapping in my pants. But I'd learned my lesson 2 years prior where I'd gotten fired. I kept going, "Save the song, save your career. Serve the song, serve the artist, serve the band, serve the producer, serve everybody. What can I do to get this song on the record?" On the record, because this song was not on the record. Cool song, very unique. It's just a kind of acoustic song. Great words, lyrics. But we had to come up with a way to arrange it and present it that had relevance. So I thank God we spent all day getting drum sounds, because back then they put drums in vocal booths. They could control the sound better. Now John wants the biggest sound in the world. We put it in a big room, but nobody knew where to put the mics. Obviously, the close mics, the overheads. But where do you put the room mics? And then what kind of chain of EQ and compression and effects do you do? And it took all day to figure this out. Meanwhile, I'm thinking, come up with a drum part that's going to save this song. So now it's my moment. I'm crapping in my pants. And the machine's going, "Goosh, goosh, goosh. Bam, boosh, doosh, doo. Bam, boosh, doosh, doo. Kablam." Kick drum on the and of three, flam on the snare drum on four, and I stopped. And I looked in the control room to get some validation. And I had nine guys going like this. So that's 18 thumbs. So, you know, my first thought was, I still got my job. That's what I thought.
Yes.
So then I thought, well, everybody goes down the drums. I'm going to go up the drums. So I was mimicking what the bass drum was doing, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, four, one, four. And I hit a dead end. Those all, no, John asked me to come in. Cortisol levels go up, adrenaline goes up. I'm scared I'm going to be fired again. And I got half the people telling me what to do and half the people telling me not what to do. Suddenly a light went off in my head. I went, "It's up to you, buddy. It's all on you to save your career." I walked out to the big room. I looked at the drums. I went, "This is like the World Series. And you're up to bat. You hit a home run, you're the hero. You strike out, you're the loser. That's the way I looked at it. So I'm 40 feet away from my drummer going, what are you going to play, Kenny? I'm 30 feet. I don't know. I'm like 20 feet. Dude, this is your career. 10 feet. I don't know what I'm going to play. I get to the drums. I put my headphones on. I'm looking at them. Look at the drums. And all of a sudden, thank God, a light went off in my head. I went, look, I have no idea what to do different. So why don't you use what you've already been doing? And in a nutshell, I took that beat that I was playing. I went up the tom-toms, but instead of starting on one, I moved the whole thing over 1/8 note. I don't know why I came up with that. Maybe it was from all the drum books I was working out of. But I went 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, And by the time I got there, John's hitting talk back. Hit a cymbal. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, boom, blam. Ba-doom. Hit the cymbal. Now I'm at the top of the drum. I just said, I'm going to take what Phil Collins used. Ran out of drums. So I made a triplet. Bapu boom, boom. Touchdown. Everybody loved it.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month. So just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
Mick Ronson from David Bowie's band was in there watching us record. He's a friend of John's. He suggested that Kenny keep playing a beat and let everybody sing some sort of a cappella thing. So let it rock, so let it roll, let the Bible Belt come save my soul. So let it rock, so let it, it was this big anthem thing. So I didn't even hear that. John just said, come on, keep playing a beat. So I started by playing 16th notes on the hi-hat and going, do, do, ga, do, ga, do, do, ga. And he goes, too much hi-hat. That was his way of talking, scream at you. Too much hi-hat. So I went, all right, mofo. And I didn't play any hi-hat. So, play some hi-hat. So I had been listening to Steve Gadd playing on a Chick Corea album. And a song called Lenore, and he was doing this thing. We go, doosh, got, doosh, da boom, doosh, got, doosh, da boom. And he hit the floor tom on beat 4. That's where I came up. Steve Gadd playing with a jazz artist influenced me to come up with boom, but that doom, boom, floor tom and snare tom. So when I played the hi hat on 3E and it opened up. Boom, but that boom, scum, boom, but got gum, scum, boom, but that doom, skagunkum. Touchdown. I didn't even hear the end result till the song was done, mastered, and recorded. It was this mammoth thing. So I'm just grateful the song got on the record. Now, back then, they released the first single. Back then, what they do is they play all the songs on top 100 radio, and people call up and say, hey, I like that song. And people can call up and voice their opinion. And they start rating. People wanted Hurt So Good. They release Hurt So Good. Hurt So Goes flying up the charts, hits number 2. For 6 weeks, we couldn't beat out Eye of the Tiger. But, you know, Rocky 1 was out. So the movie is selling the record, the record's selling the movie. So there's no way we're going to beat out Eye of the Tiger. So they start seeing that Jack and Diane is testing so high. Everybody likes that song. They'll play it specifically in certain markets, maybe New York, Seattle, Boston, whatever. Tested so high, they release it as the second single. As Jack and Diane goes down to 3 and 4, release Jack and Diane. Now, we're like, really? That's your next single? Jack and Diane goes flying all the way hits number one. Hurt So Good goes back up. Now we got two songs in the top 10. We're all over MTV. Next thing you know, we're on Saturday Night Live. You know, all the TV shows, Solid Gold, Dick Clark, you name it, we're on it. SCTV up in Canada. John's career completely blows up. My career is launched. Who's that drummer? And the room I was in at Chateau Marmont Hotel on Sunset when I got fired 2 years ago, I was in that same room when that song went to number one. And here's what I did. I celebrated for 2 seconds, and then I went, holy shit, I'm not number one. I got to do it again. How am I going to do it again? He hasn't written a song yet. I got to wait for John to write a song, and then I got to come up with a great drum part to prove that I'm a great drummer. That was what's in my mind. It's like a running back in football. They get a touchdown, they're immediately like, I need to do this again to show people that I'm really good. It's not like a one-off deal. So I never bought that number one thing. I was grateful, but I was like, I got to do it again. What's next? What do I do? I need to practice. How can I get better? You know, I have a saying, it goes like this. I'll never be as great as I want to be, but I'm willing to spend my entire life trying to be as great as I can be. I mean, that's just like, it's like a running back in football. They don't score touchdowns every time they get the ball. Sometimes they do. Sometimes 5 yards, sometimes zero, sometimes minus two, sometimes fumble. Sometimes they break their leg in preseason and they're out. But they come back because they love football. I'm a running back in the music business. I just keep going in the end zone. Give me it again. Try again.
Workhorse.
Yeah. Go.
Yeah.
And that's how you build.
Incredible.
That's how you build a career.
Incredible stuff. It sounds like you're so driven as well, and it's such an environment for that, because by the sounds of it, John was a bit of a taskmaster as well, and you're working and you're pushing yourselves, mm-hmm. Between you and the group and John and everyone is really trying to bring out the best in everybody, and it just sounds like almost the best way to start a career, because from that point on you can only go and keep developing and pushing yourself.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the thing is that you either get it or you don't.
Yes.
You know, some people would go on like, I'm out of here. And two guys did quit in the making of American Fool after I'd been in 2 years. They went, it's not worth it. Not me. I'm not saying it was enjoyable. I mean, it was enjoyable times, but it was tough. But I recognized this is incredible. I'll be playing with John real soon for a big event at the Indianapolis Stadium, the Colts Stadium, Indianapolis. I go up to him and hug him and say, I mean, I did the Kennedy Center Honors with him, and I've done Music Cares. I'm always grateful. Man, I learned so much by being around him and watching how he handled things. Learned so much. I won't even list it. It was just incredible. Totally invaluable. At the time, I didn't realize everything I was learning. But I see it now. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And also going through that type of experience, fighting to become great and being part of having a leader that didn't drink, didn't do drugs, totally clear-minded, you know, and just driven, everything from what you wear, the way we look on stage, the way we move, being very aware of the brand before we even knew what that word meant. And being around that was, like you said, was an incredible foundation to deal with all kinds of things from that point on, the easiest things and the hardest things.
Absolutely. And then you mentioned, obviously, following on from John deciding to take a break from the music business, that you decided you were going to put your efforts into serving loads of different people and becoming the best session drummer out there. And you wouldn't commit to just one person again. It would be all the different people. And it was Don Was, wasn't it, that really helped you get your way into that kind of way of working?
Yes. I was working with Don Was. He called me up and asked me if I could do a Bob Dylan record. And then Bob was on tour. So I'm like freaking out. Are you kidding me? But then Bob couldn't do it because he was on tour for a while. Then he says, well, how about Iggy Pop? I'm like, are you kidding me? Yeah. And I'm recording an Iggy Pop record. And Don, he went to the Grammys. I was like so focused on just drums, Iggy Pop. And all of a sudden I walk in one day and I said, where's Don? He said, oh, he had to go to the Grammys. We recorded a little bit and then he went to the Grammys. And he wins two Grammys, one for Nick of Time with Bonnie Raitt, which was her comeback record. And then he won Love Shack for the B-52s. He produced that. And all of a sudden, Don's got two Grammys. There's our guy, barefoot, glasses. And he comes back, and next thing you know, he said, hey, you want to record a Bob Seger record? Yeah. Hey, you want to record Elton John four songs? Yeah. And it went on and on and on. And all of a sudden, Don blew up, and I was right there with him. The Highwaymen, which is Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, and Waylon Jennings. Movie soundtracks. I mean, I could go on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And B.B. King and Bonnie Raitt at the same time doing a song for Air America. I mean, it was unbelievable. And all of a sudden, my cred went up outside of John Mellencamp, and I suddenly realized I had two careers. And there's where the conflict came in, because I was on a very small retainer. I took myself off retainer with the idea that if he calls, I'm not on retainer anymore. And he did call. I was doing a Little Feat record. The Little Feat band, Richie Haywood, the incredible drummer who was playing with Eric Clapton, they got me to play with them, and we were backing up like the Madonna of Sweden. She was a megastar, stadium. So we did that record, and I get a call that, you know, from John's right-hand man, said that John needs you this Thursday. I said, I can't. I'm working 2 weeks with Little Feat. John says, look, you know, you can do that stuff, but when I need you, I need you. I totally get it. But I said, John, they moved their entire schedule to accommodate me. And they built this whole session around me. I can't leave. And so we just, I get it. I mean, John wanted a drummer that was accessible 24/7. And I was becoming that guy that was not accessible 24/7. And eventually, you know, we just parted ways.
I remember Leland Sklar saying that sometimes he kind of wished that he was part of a band, and he was like almost like Flea, where he had one band and he travelled and he only had to learn those songs rather than everybody else's songs and that sort of thing. I mean, he's had an incredible career, same as you, but do you sometimes wish that you were part of a band in that way, that you didn't have to float between everything, or would you not have got the kind of buzz that you got from doing what you did with so many different people and so many different genres and styles and places like that?
Oh, I definitely think I like playing with everybody. You know, even when I was in the Mellencamp band, as big as we were, when I started recording with like Brian Setzer or Belinda Carlisle, you know, we did Heaven on Earth, her first number one hit single outside of the Go-Go's. Yeah. I mean, that was such a rush. Or Bob Seger, or, you know, going on tour with, you know, the Smashing Pumpkins. Recording with John Fogerty, you know, I mean, oh man, or Joe Cocker. I mean, this is like incredible. So yeah, I want both. I want both, you know. I like playing with lots of different people because it's stimulating. It makes me feel good mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. So yeah, I don't know if Lee would have been happy with just one band. Sure, I'd love to have been in Led Zeppelin, yeah. But I think I still would have always wanted to do other things. It's just the way I'm wired.
Yeah, absolutely. It's worked for you. You've thrown out even more names there. Let's touch on a couple of them. I mean, John Fogerty, absolute legend, as you said. Playing with someone like that who's got such a rich history before you join him, and everyone knows how he sounds and how Creedence sounded and things like that. So what was it like when you joined John and you were backing up him? What advice or what instruction did he give to you?
Well, the thing about John, I mean, he was my hero. I was just I was a kid, a teenager, you know, listening to Creedence, you know, almost went to Woodstock. I only grew up 3.5 hours away and I missed it. But man, so when I get the call, I had no idea, but I was the 30th drummer after 5 years of recording his record, Blue Moon Swamp. 30th drummer. Somebody finally recommends Kenny Aronoff. And I was told not to even bring my drums. I'm like, really? And I got there. And he would tune the snare drum, and it was my favorite snare drum, Superphonic 400 Ludwig 5x14, which I ended up creating my signature series snare drums. That's a 6x14. They're only making 25 of them, 40 years being with Tama. Hand engraved, it's my tattoo engraved around that drum. But anyway, the first edition was a 5x14, and that was a model off of his favorite snare drum, the Superphonic 400 Ludwig. But he would tune his kick drum and snare drum and have somebody tune the toms. We'd play a very simple song. We'd play it twice. It was just bass, guitar, and him singing, and me. Go in and listen to two takes. Let me make a few suggestions. Go out, do two more. Come back and listen. Two more. Come back. After eight takes, I went, that's pretty damn good, John. I think we got it. He went, nah, I think we'll revisit that a little bit longer. So we do it for 3.5 hours, then have a lunch break, then go to the next song. At the end of the day, he goes, Kenny, you're the drummer I've been looking for my entire life.
Wow.
Would you come? Yeah, exactly. Wow. And now you have to understand, he's a genius. He writes the songs, writes the lyrics, arranges the songs. He is the genius behind, you know, Creedence, all those songs. He was the arranger, the producer, the brain behind all of it. Incredible musicologist. He hears things and remembers it and then applies it. So I went, absolutely, I'll come back tomorrow. And he was very happy. He says, you know, and so I come back the next day. I go to the engineer, what are we doing today? And he's laughing. Same two songs. I went, what? What did I do wrong? He said, no, he just likes to do it. So we did the same two songs on Tuesday, 3.5 hours each song. And we come back the next day, and it's the same two songs.
Oh, my word.
Come back Thursday, same two songs. I mean, you're talking about a guy who gets something in 2 or 3 takes. Finally, Friday. And it seemed like he picked the take on Friday, take 12 or 13, he said, on Friday. Probably because by then, we'd been on tour playing those songs. And the energy and the spirit and the vibe on Friday at take 12 or 13 was just magical. Now, I found out later, he wasn't even keeping the bass or his guitar or vocals. He was just going after drum takes.
Oh, wow.
Unbelievable. And so then he asked me to come back the next week, and I went, same two songs? He went, nope. And I walked in one day, and I saw a stack of 2-inch tape, like one inch wide. I went, the engineer, what is that? And he went, Backbeats. I went, what? He said, not yours. No, not yours. What he would do, and this is what he did in Creedence, if he'd hear a backbeat that was a little bit, or let's say a little bit late, if it was late, he'd cut a piece out of the tape out and stick it together with scotch tape. If it was early, he would add a little bit of tape to make it so it would land right in the right spot. He did that back in the day with Creedence, before anybody knew that you could cut tape. He was like creating innovative ideas to solve problems. Back in the Creedence days, he took those little tape edits, those little pieces of tape, put them in an envelope and knocked on Doug Clifford's door. I think he said that in his autobiography. He says, here's your backbeats. Anyway, that's the type of how focused he was. And that record won a Grammy, and then he asked me to go on tour. And I went, I'm in. To play those songs. You see, he had not played his Creedence songs for 20 years. But when I went on tour, we played the Creedence song. It was incredible. All the hits. Actually, you can't play all the hits in one show. It takes 2 shows, maybe 3, to play all his hits.
Someone else that you mentioned, Smashing Pumpkins, quickly touching on them, because you joined them, I think it was just after the Adore album was recorded, I think it was, for the tour, wasn't it? And I saw an interview with Billy Corgan that once said that he made the mistake of hiring additional percussion players. He should have just left it to you and backing loops from the album, that sort of thing. Now, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, they were my favorite, one of my favorite bands at that time. I was a huge fan. They were the biggest alternative band in the world, bigger than Pearl Jam, Nirvana. I mean, they were huge. And they had done Gish, Siamese Dream, and Melancholy, and then they had just recorded Door, and I was the drummer. I won an audition to do the tour, which was huge. I was shocked that they had 2 massive percussion setups to the right of me and to the left of me back there. Now, Billy didn't hear all the noise because between the percussion and him was his Marshall stacks. And the same with James Iha. But I heard all of it. And it was like a lot of chaos going on. And I remember saying at one point early in the tour, I went to that percussionist. I said, dude, can you hear what he's doing? He says, no. And I said, dude, can you hear what he's doing? No. I says, no shit. I can hear what both of you doing. It's completely crazy. It's like 2 lawnmowers going at 2 different tempos. They were both doing creative stuff, but it was so much stuff, you know, and it had a vibe to it. But it was very intense for me because my job was to hold this band down in, you know, I had click track to make sure we went, played every song in tempo. So I'm playing, we have a structure, but when we get to these certain sections, where, you know, I had to just guess where he wanted to go. So it was a combination of structure and a lot of dynamics and improvising. And it was an incredible experience for me because most of the bands I played, when you want, like Bob Seger, he wants the same cymbal crash every night, same place. I mean, Billy was like that in many ways too. He had a photographic memory and he'd want certain things right in the same place, but then he wanted you to be able to just build. And he told me, what you're going to do in this band you haven't done before, which is play massive range of dynamics. And he was right. It was an incredible experience.
Fantastic.
Incredible experience.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And just touching on one last thing, I mean, it's an incredible thing to leave till last. I've spoken to so many people and they all say the same thing, that their way into the music business and their love of the music business and want to be a rock star came from one special night watching the TV when four long-haired guys from Liverpool appeared in front of millions of people in America. Yeah. And, well, you're the same. You watched that special night as well. And you got to experience what many people could only dream of when you performed at this special night, the night that changed America, and you got to perform on stage with Ringo and with Sir Paul and all the other incredible guests that came on that night. I mean, just talk to me about how that felt playing with those guys and that night in general and everyone that was involved.
Well, first of all, 50 years after I see the Beatles and I ask my mom to call them up and get me in the band, which she didn't, obviously. And I realized what my purpose in life was before I even knew what those words meant, but I knew I wanted to do that. And now 50 years later, I'm playing with them, honoring for that amazing night. That was extremely emotional, but like being in the Super Bowl, I had to focus on winning the game. And so I put those emotions aside and focus song by song by song. After every song, when I do a show like that, I get the script of the show. I know who has to read the teleprompter. If the teleprompter doesn't work, I mean, look at the artist, look at the stage manager. And if the producers are the same thing. So I know when to count off. I'm very highly aware of what's going on. And I'm a problem solver in a situation like that. A lot of things can go wrong. So I have to be ready to adapt, to make the show go right. And a matter of fact, I walked on stage the first day of sound check for the show, and I heard somebody say, "God, thank God he's here." I'm like, who? He went, "You." I went, "Oh, wow." And what it was the guy was going, the producer was there. It was like, geez, I know that, you know, he's seen me do Kennedy Center Honors, all these big specials I did with Don Was. He knows that I get the job done, you know, and I focus. And that's what I did. And it was at the end that I kind of went, "Oh my God." And I was hanging with Paul and Ringo, and they're telling us stories from Liverpool before the show, like in between rehearsal and the show. I'm hanging with Paul and Ringo talking about what it was like to be in Hamburg, you know, playing in the clubs and chords and smoking fags, as they call it. And I mean, I just couldn't believe it. It was me, Don Was, Ben Montench from Petty's band with Ringo and Paul. So all this stuff, you know, and Ringo edifying me when I walked out, I had 30 minutes left. There was 30 minutes left in the show, and I had played with Dave Grohl, John Legend and Alicia Keys, Joe Walsh, Jeff Lynne from ELO, John Mayer, Keith Urban, to name a few. I walk out to the audience to look for my wife, and there's Tom Hanks, his wife, Ringo Starr and his wife, Paul McCartney, his girlfriend, John Lennon and George Harrison's widows, then Sean Penn, Johnny Depp and Tom Cruise, all there in a row. They're all acknowledging me, but Ringo's applauding and going, "Bravo, Kenny, bravo." I'm like, okay, this is my moment. I just played the Grammys with him the night before, right on that same stage, the Grammys. And 2 weeks before I'd done a thing where we honored him, I got to play double drums on four songs, which, by the way, nobody plays like Ringo. Nobody, not even close. It's a unique feel and sound. Anyway, I get on my knee because everyone's looking at me in the place of like 10, 12,000 people there. I get on my knee and I'm trying to think of what I'm going to say to him. And he goes, "That's okay, Kenny, I'm already married." I went, "No, dude, you're the reason why I play drums. You're the reason why I play rock and roll music. You and the Beatles helped me realize my purpose in life, and I just want to thank you." And that was it, and I walked away. It was an amazing moment.
Wow. Absolutely incredible. And some of the names that you throw out are just absolutely just mind-boggling to think you've played with all these sorts of people. Is there anybody that you haven't played with that you wish you had have done or you really want to in future?
Oh, well, I've played with Dave Grohl, but I mean, being the Foo Fighters would be so cool. Or Josh Homme from Queens of the Stone Age. I think he's brilliant. Yeah. I'd love to play. You know, I recorded an album with Tony Iommi from Sabbath and Glenn Hughes from Deep Purple. That was a band. We did it in Wales at Monmouth Studios. I mean, that. So who else? I mean, this is
just touching on that quickly. Sorry to butt in there. I don't like to interrupt, but Tony Iommi, working with him, I've spoken with a few people that have worked with him over the years, and he's just the master of the riff, and he gets stuff done as well. I mean, what was it like working with him?
Great. It was awesome. Nicest guy in the world. Humble, sweet. Email him every so often. We keep talking about making another record. He was amazing, but oh my God, his sound and his feel. It was unbelievable. And every riff. I remember Billy Corgan was producing two songs and I recorded on it with Billy in LA, Tony's first record. Billy comes in. I'd met Tony. We're hanging out. Billy comes in and goes right. Billy doesn't hang out. He goes right to business. He says, "Tony, play me a lick." Wow. Billy goes, da, 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 and play me another one. Billy goes, drums. We go out there. Next thing you know, we're making a record or a song off of those licks. It was insane. Each lick was like a movie theme or something. It's incredible.
Absolutely bonkers. Well, Kenny, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you for this last hour or so. Wonderful stories you've got to tell, and even more so in your book. So just plug your book one last time for us.
Well, I actually have it right back here. The book is called Sex, Drums, Rock and Roll, The Hardest Hitting Man in Showbiz. And the book is basically about growing up in a small town of 3,000 people and not knowing, realizing what I want to do for my entire life, but not knowing how to begin to do that. And to end up where I am. It's about hard work, self-discipline, and perseverance. Nobody's born successful, and success does not land in your lap. You have to make it happen. And that's what that story is about.
Absolutely. You are a driven individual, that is for sure. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, Kenny. Best of luck for everything in the future, and hopefully chat with you again soon.
All right, man. Take care.
So there you go, the brilliant Kenny Aronoff there, a fantastic guest with some fantastic stories. I really do hope you enjoyed listening to that. Anyway, that's it for me then and this week's show. Thanks again for listening. Make sure you subscribe on your podcast app so that you get all your episodes downloaded every single Monday. I've got some fantastic guests lined up to bring you over the next few weeks as well, so you want to make sure that you hit that subscribe button. And while you're there, please leave a 5-star review on that podcast app as well. It really makes a big difference when it comes to exposure and showing it to other people and things like that. Anyway, thank you so much for your time today. I hope you'll be back next week to listen to another fantastic guest, and really, it is a good one. So until then, take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.